Hey, this is Andy. Before we get into today's pod, I wanted to thank somebody that has done a lot for me and our show. I'm talking about you. And not only because you listen to the show, which honestly is kind of an awesome mind-boggling thing on its own, but because you support the work we do as well. It's your support that allows our entire team, that's me, Larry, and a few others, to spend hours and hours reading, watching, listening to the news, boiling it down to that bullion cube of insight and criticism that we aim to deliver to your ears each week, to keep the show going strong, and to keep the lights on. To keep the mics on, we need all of our listeners to participate. So here's what we're looking for right now. We're looking for new members. If you've never supported the show, now is honestly a perfect time. Returning members, many of you have given in the past, but maybe you haven't in a little while. Well, we're here to welcome you back into the FYP family, and sustaining members, there are a ton of you, thank you so much. But maybe you could do a little more to chip in a little extra. But maybe you could chip in a little extra, add $3 or $5 to your monthly gift that would do a lot for Registry Matters. No matter who you are, we could really use the help right now. To support Registry Matters, go to registrymatters.co or patreon.com/registrymatters. And now on to the show. Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 175. It's May 1st, Larry, of Registry Matters. Happy Saturday night. How are you?
Well, very well. Thank you. It's good to be here. And it has caught up. We have caught up with my age.
Oh, sweet. I've never known that you were 175. Wow. That's very impressive. Are you celebrating with any beverages this evening?
Just vodka.
Just vodka? This doesn't have anything to do with the pain from the accident of last week?
It does, but vodka is very effective. All you have to do is just swallow fast.
Oh, doesn't it like burn? Like, I know you're not a drinker, but I hear that junk burns like an MF as it does its thing.
I have heard that.
Just a quick update. We talked about it last week briefly, that you got into a significant tail-ending accident. And how are you? Physically, how are you?
Well, I'm still in pain. I still have lacerations that haven't healed, and I'm still waiting to see my dental professional to see how bad the face is smashed on the inside. But I'm still alive. They didn't get rid of me. But guess what? There was another accident 1 week later to the day, the same spot, maybe 20 feet further north. Same location.
You had mentioned something about possibly breaking your hand. Did you go check that out?
Oh, yeah. There was no fracture.
Okay.
Well, the pain hasn't gone away, but there's no fractures.
All right, then. Well, we got the humanitarian side of things out of the way. Now we need to go on to the meat and potatoes. What's going on tonight?
Well, we have a jam-packed episode. We have four questions. We have a story from the state of Iowa. We're going to talk about the Supreme Court in a recent decision dealing with PFRs. We're going to talk about the Prison Litigation Reform Act, and going to cover some articles if we have time, like second chances in Alabama and Michigan, and then you have to look at the one on the Mississippi prisons ending the food contract. Now that one is bizarre. I can't say funny anymore because the person last week on YouTube said that nothing's funny. But when I say funny, I'm talking about ironic. But anyway, I can't say that anymore. It's not PC.
Okay. Well, then let's get going. This one came in something of a week ago, or maybe even more. It's from a new patron. It says, "Hi, guys. Longtime listener, new supporter. Thank you again." That was from Sean. I think we reported maybe a week or two ago. "I have a 3-year review coming up to try and shorten a 5-year probation period for misdemeanor convictions. I've been told by 2 POs that they are required to recommend the completion of the original 5-year probation period when asked by the judge, even though I've been told on numerous occasions how much of a waste of time the whole thing is. The question on my mind lately is this. If during a legal proceeding the judge asks the opinion of a PO, if the response of recommending to stay on probation is said because they are required to say that, isn't that some form of perjury that could be argued in court? It seems like that's a pretty important question that could have a huge impact on the outcome of the hearing. It seems that if a judge is asking the opinion of an expert, that is the opinion, excuse me, that if the opinion is forced or coerced, it's a pretty big problem. What are your thoughts? And then after we finish that, I have one other final thing to bring up. But that does sound legit, Larry, that the PO should be responding how they feel about your caseload, how you respond under treatment and so forth, that they should say whether they think you should be on their case or not. Not that they're like, oh, it's the default position of probation to say that you should stay on. So aren't they lying?
No, they're not lying. They're telling the truth. They're telling the truth as that they've been instructed to tell it. Our department policy is that we don't recommend a particular action. So there's no lie there. It's just that they're declining to give an opinion. But remember, I don't think I've done the world the way it is be for a long time. There's the way things should be, and there's the way things are. And in this case, the way it should be would be a PO would give their opinion, and they would give it based on all the factors you were articulating, the caseload they have, and how well this person has performed and following the restrictions and complying. They would do that. But in the world the way it is, they're not likely to do that because the last thing they want is for those cameras to come in on them if there is a relapse. And their supervisors want it even less than they do. And the people who run the department want it even less than all the ones previously mentioned. So therefore, they're not going to give their opinion when they've been instructed not to. That would be an insubordinate act, would it not?
It would be. So and then I guess the way that I'm going to present myself as legal expert, which I know I'm not, so don't take me this way. But then your attorney would ask the specific question of, has the person ever caused any problems? Have they always met their probation obligations? And you're never asking them for anything that is beyond fact for them to give them any room to, you're going to leave it to the judge is what I'm saying, that this person is only there to state the facts of how you are under their charge. And then the judge would then make the determination of whether you are released or not.
That is absolutely what does happen in those cases in those instances where they have that policy. The lawyer has to be skilled at eliciting the answer that the lawyer is looking for. And then the cameras will come in on the judge because the prosecution is going to take the same posture in all likelihood when that issue is being heard. The state's going to be consistent with probation. They're going to say either they oppose it or we take no position. You can hope for them to take no position, but they're likely going to oppose the release. And therefore, they're going to dredge up something from the facts of your case that happened all these years ago to say that's their justification for opposing it. So you're going to end up in a position where it's going to be on the judge, and a judge is going to be thinking about Persky from time to time when they're making these decisions.
Right.
For those who
Judge
don't
Persky
remember,
was the one that was recalled by the Stanford swimmer, and he got recalled in California 3 years ago.
Correct. But a judge who has to be elected, and that happens in many states. A judge who has to be elected is going to be very sensitive to that. Our state, they don't have to be elected per se. They have to be retained after they've been appointed and gone through one election. And the retention threshold is 57% to either retain. And if they don't reach that threshold, they're not retained. But even with that system, there's enough bad press that can really impair your retention election. So therefore, these judges, the world the way it should be, and the world the way it is. And I don't see the perjury, but he does have a fantastic point. It really makes it difficult when the POs will not give an opinion about a particular offender.
And we could, just personal experience, back to my case, seeing the judge, whatever, November is what it was. The prosecution, the DA's office, they did not say, well, no, we don't have any problem, but they were like, we're not going to ever say that we think that this person should be off. But they certainly did not come in there with any guns blazing. They came in with like little cap guns, so to speak. They did not approve it, but they were not coming out guns blazing trying to prevent it either. That's certainly another situation that could come up.
Absolutely. And you were fortunate that they weren't vocal and they didn't dredge up something in the way of facts related to the case saying this person should not be released. But those kind of things do happen. And that's what your lawyer is supposed to tell you. when they take your money, they're supposed to tell you, look, here's the way it plays out in this jurisdiction. They're going to come in with all guns blazing. They're going to say this. That's why you go have the conversation with the DA, with the prosecution. You have the conversation. What are you going to do? What is your office going to say when I file this petition? And if you don't
and
do
to
that,
to clarify a point for you, that's you said that's not a conversation. The PO person, the probation person, I can't go ask the DA, hey, what do you think about me?
Well, you
need
could.
Someone else to go in there for you. Oh yeah, okay, I'm with you. You could go do it.
if they would see you, they'd be unlikely to see you. But if they're not going to give you the kind of feedback that they'll give an attorney, particular person who practices in that jurisdiction, and they have a relationship. They're going to be more honest and say, look, you know, we're going to strenuously oppose this person's release, or they're going to say we're going to take a non-oppositional stance or whatever. That's why you pay the attorney.
I see. I think we're done with that. Are we done?
Sure.
All right. I just wanted to bring up this. Sean also said, hey, could you make it so that we could pay a lump sum annual payment rather than monthly? And I converted Patreon over to allow us to be able to do it if you want to do that. I forgot how much of a discount. I think it's a 1 month roughly discount if you pay in advance for a year. So there you go. You could go over to Patreon and sign up for a year at a time, and you'll get something of a 1 month discount in doing so. So there's that. So there you go. Question number dose. It says, hello, we are writing to you about info regarding the new tier law in California. We wish to know what the tiers are and the requirements, please. If you could answer this within your newsletter or give us a copy of it in writing. Thank you and God bless. P.S. If you have any info on resources in California that could appeal, that'd be great too. Thank you. That's certainly, that's right up there with Axel, right?
That is, and I'm not going to be able to be as specific because there are too many offenses. California has had a registry since 1947, and they have a very, very long list. So what they did with their tier system is they took the categorical approach and they put the offenses in a particular tier based on the offense itself. And where they went wrong many places, but where they went wrong is the tier ones and the tier twos do not have to file a petition. Pursuant, if you're actually following the federal recommendations, those people just vanish after their 15 or 25 years passes. Tier 1's 15 with a 5-year reduction for no felony conviction or any sexual conviction of any sexual conviction period. Then you can be released after 10 years, and also there's provision that you have to have gone through treatment. A tier 2 is 25 years. Again, no petitions needed. The tier 3. There is no petition process if you're actually following the federal recommendation. There's no tier three except for an adjudicated juvenile offender. But what California did is they put this categorical approach in, and they put the offenses in tiers. They require you to file petitions even though it's not required by federal recommendations. And then the process is so cumbersome, you have to serve it on the police department in the where you're registered. They get 45 days or something to check your background to see if you've been convicted of anything. Then they clear you, and then the DA's next, and the DA has to notify a victim, make an effort to notify the victims, and the victims get a say-so in it. And then the judge has this very vague standard that if there's any reason practically to keep you on the registry, they can keep you on the registry. The removal will be sparse and far and few between. Now, I say that, and I get hate mail, I get criticism, but I'm telling you, it will be very difficult to get off California's registry. They had no reason to create a petition process for Tier 1 or Tier 2 except to placate the victims and the prosecution and the law enforcement industrial complex. And they didn't need to do it. And also, it's going to be a big business for the lawyers. There'll be a lot of people who will not be honest. They will tell them what they want to hear, that I can file this petition and you stand a good chance of getting off the registry. Truth of the matter is, when a lawyer tells you that, they do not know what chance you stand getting off the registry because this is a new process, and they're telling you what you want to hear. But far be it from me to actually tell you the truth. It is a very difficult process in California. And remember, if you file and you get off in California, that only relieves you of California's registration obligation. It doesn't do anything else for you in any other state.
And maybe let me try and explain it in my own words. Like, just so one word answer. There is no federal registration, right?
Right.
And AWA is, I guess it's law, but it's like they're not holding the states accountable to it. Like, if you break the law, then we're going to send your state to jail. You either abide by these guidelines or you don't, and you're compliant or not. But there's no consequences for it other than some money. So California and any other state can go above and below the requirements however they choose to.
So you're dealing with
California.
That is correct. Again, folks, there's no federal registry. These AWA recommend, they're just recommendations. If you want to have a federally compliant registry where you get your full allocation of federal burn justice grants, you will have registries up to this level, and you can go higher, but this is what you'll have. If you go beyond it and do more, that's okay. But California did not need to do this. First of all, they've said that they're not even going to attempt to comply with AWA. That's been their posture for some number of years. But then they created this cumbersome removal process because everybody's lifetime in California, they created this removal process that will virtually remove no one.
Sad, because it's a, I don't know otherwise how they are in a criminal justice sense, where we often talk about the Northeast corridor there, that's all more friendly to criminal justice thing. I don't know how California is in those regards. Everyone talks about the left coast being super progressive and whatnot, but this seems to be an outlier of California to be this way.
Oh, I don't think so. What happens is when you get a collection of liberals, in many ways they can be as bad as a collection of conservatives, because they do things because it makes them feel good, and it made them feel good to have the victims take part in developing this removal process. The only problem is, well, there are many problems, but the most significant problem is that the victims are not interested in having a fair removal process. They're interested in more vengeance. The victims should not be included in the removal process, period. This is a civil regulatory scheme. I would have said that at the time, but see, most people that are required to register and their advocates are afraid to utter those words, that it's a civil regulatory scheme. The punishment is over with. This is a civil regulatory scheme. You don't get to participate in the civil regulatory scheme. But nobody had the courage to say that.
All right. I guess we'll move on to question number 3. And here we go. It says, being incarcerated for a picture crime, rumors and myths circulated that social media platforms, example, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, block all PFRs. In similar rumors are associated with Walt Disney World, Florida. Are there any legitimacy to these? Is there any legitimacy to these claims? If so, is it indiscriminate basis? Is it discriminatory discriminate basis from registry databases? Whew, this is hard to read. I think they are saying that, are they using the registry databases to find this information, or is it more individualized, such as prior accounts scrutinized and or utilized in commission of the offense? With the GOP,
you can stop there.
Okay.
Yeah, I meant to block that out. That was all okay, a political okay. rant there.
All right.
So the answer is the rumors are true. I don't know about Walt Disney. I've heard that rumor, but I have not independently verified it. But in terms of the social media platforms, those rumors are true. It's an indiscriminate blocking of people who are required to register. There's no individualized analysis done. That's true.
And should they be allowed to?
Well, that's what the courts are going to determine someday. But he went on to political rant about the Hunter Biden story being suppressed by the New York Times and blah blah blah. And I just didn't want to go there. But in terms of his question. These things are true. They do block you on Facebook and Twitter and so forth. And I don't know about YouTube. I don't know if YouTube blocks PFRs.
I've never heard of anybody getting shut off of Google. That's not one I've ever heard of. And I don't know that I've ever heard of anybody being knocked off of Twitter either. I mean, we obviously have the Registry Matters Twitter account. There's also a Facebook one. But the Twitter account, I post on there at least roughly weekly, and it's never been shut down. But my question is, should they be allowed to, and maybe that's taking too far of a left turn, of them being private companies and being allowed to, let's focus more on Disney World, that you are, forgive the extension here for me from just a second. You are someone that has been convicted of a sex crime, and I'm not saying that you were convicted of one that's a child-based one, but you're going to a place that predominantly caters to children, and they are a private entity, and they probably have a sign that says, we can refuse the right to admittance to anybody. So that's their privilege to do so, I think.
Well, I wouldn't go so far. You'd have to look at how much tax subsidies that they may have gotten, you know, in the way big companies are very, very skilled at figuring out how to get benefits for operating businesses in an area, particularly a large employer like that. But I can tell you they've been under a lot of pressure. I mean, cruise operators are under a lot of pressure. Anybody that has a recreation component that involves a lot of minors as customers, they're under a lot of pressure to keep folks safe. And so they're responding to public pressure. That's what the public is demanding, that we don't want PFRs roaming around here trolling to victimize our children while they're having a good time. So Disney is being a good corporate citizen in their view.
Okie dokie. Is there anything else there before we move on to the next one?
No, we can go on to number, whichever one we are on.
I think we're on number 4, as you have posted the PDFs. All right, it says, I have not been able to get a straight answer to my question, though I know I'm not the only one to face this situation. I have an established longtime residence in Pennsylvania, driver's license, etc. In 2015, I was arrested while on vacation in North Carolina and ultimately convicted of something for a 2005 offense, in federal Connecticut.
Federal,
at sentencing,
federal
the judge. Federal court. If you put CT, I'm going to say Connecticut, Larry. At sentencing, the judge ordered me to register as an SO upon release, which should be not so far off. In 2017, PA declared SORNA as punishment, both state and federally, through a Supreme Court decision. Since non-contact offenses, such as possession, receipt, were not subject to registration until 2006, my 2005 offense should be exempt from registering ex post facto in Pennsylvania. North Carolina, however, refuses to recognize the punishing effects of SORNA. My question, how will my out-of-state conviction of 2005 affect me as far as the registry goes? Will I still have to register even though it's unconstitutional in Pennsylvania? What happens if I cross state lines or move out of state? Is there ever a time where it is no longer a concern, or do I have to stay in Pennsylvania for the rest of my life? I have seen the push by the government for a federal duty to register as a way to circumvent the states. If I register out of state first before Pennsylvania says I'm exempt, will I then be removed from the out-of-state registry, or will I have to maintain it for the next 10 years? I would be very grateful for any light you can shed for me on this subject. There's a lot going on there, Larry.
Yeah, and he's not going to like the answers I give him, but I'm actually, he says nope. But he says nobody can answer the question. I can actually answer this question very succinctly and accurately. He needs to stop thinking about Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is only relevant if he lives there. So if he's not choosing to live in Pennsylvania, remember, when you take your car across state lines, you comply with the registration requirements in the state where your vehicle is moved to. In this case, the vehicle is you. And if you take yourself to another state, you will register according to what that state's requirements are. Now, it could be, in some instances, the state that you move to may incorporate the requirement to make it approximate what you had in the previous state. Example, Utah does that. They say you will register for 10 years or the amount of time required in the state where you were convicted to make sure you don't receive a benefit for moving to Utah. So the judge just simply apprised him of his duty to register as a sexual offender. But he gets to North Carolina. North Carolina has their own registration requirements. They have their own system in terms of the duration. They have their own removal processes. And if you're going to live in North Carolina, you will be subject to what North Carolina requires. So I've answered that part of the question. If you live in North Carolina, yep, you will comply with North Carolina law. In terms of what happens if you move to another state, if you leave North Carolina, you will comply with the state that you move to. So I've answered that part of the question.
Yep.
About whether it's unconstitutional in Pennsylvania, it was ruled unconstitutional, but they have since reconstituted a registry that has not been ruled unconstitutional. So if you were to live in PA, you might very well have to register there. His argument is that a crime of 2005 occurred prior to when they did their massive amendments that caused their registry to be vulnerable. They had a registry in 2005. Believe me, they had a registry since the late 90s. All states did, but if he can live without registration in Pennsylvania, if that is in fact true, that is exactly what he should do, because that is the only place where he will be home free, and that still may not make him home free, because they can, since it's a regulatory scheme, as long as it's benign enough that it's not deemed as punishment, they can continue to require him to register in Pennsylvania. So I've answered every single question that he asked, not with answers that he likes, but every single thing he asked. There is no federal registry. But if you cross state lines, we're going to get to that later in the main event. If you cross state lines, you will be prosecuted because you have engaged in interstate commerce and you have not registered in the new state. You have to present yourself for registration in the new state, or you've committed a federal offense.
Larry, we decided in chat that nobody likes your answers, ever. I'm sorry but I'm pretty sure your answers are right, and that's why you're here. I think I have a button that does this. Hang on, wait, I got it.
That is why I am here.
Because that's why you're here, because you're right. And nobody likes it. And let's just touch on that for just a minute. It's a regulatory scheme similar to car stuff, that if you're in California, you're going to have much more emissions controls than if you're living probably in New Mexico. I'm going to guess that you have very limited emissions control.
That would be correct.
Okay. And so you just, hey, I would like to move my car, and you're moving from New Mexico to California. They're going to say, you got to do all the smog stuff. And you're like, but I didn't have to in New Mexico. Well, sorry, you're not in New Mexico, are you? Same thing applies here, that whatever North Carolina says. North Carolina says that you have to go to work doing handstands. Well, those are the regulations you have to comply with. And when you move to Pennsylvania, they don't make you do that. So then you don't have to do it because you're not there anymore.
That is correct. And I wish I could give them the different answer. I wish that we had reciprocity among the states. I wish we had more uniformity among the states. And of course, I don't wish we had uniformity with the harshness of the southeastern part of the country has, the deep south. But I wish that it was not so confusing. And I wish that when you finished in one state, you were finished everywhere. I wish all that stuff, but that's not the way it is.
But even again, using the car comparison, you could have a car that is considered a classic, and in your state, then you don't have to comply with certain things. You move that car to another state, and then all of a sudden, you have to come back into some kind of compliance. All of that would then still hold true. It is very akin to this kind of thing. But there's that disabilities and restraints part of it, where the pictures on websites, potentially living and work restrictions, potentially presence restrictions, internet restrictions, and so forth. I mean, the people in North Carolina prior to Packingham, they couldn't be on anything related to social media. This is post probation, all that stuff, that you're just a PFR on the website and you can't be on social media. That's how it used to be. That's a disability and restraint.
That's correct. And litigation, we may have more and more of these restrictions declared unconstitutional. But right now, he's going to have to comply with whatever state he's in. And Pennsylvania is not in the equation unless he lives there.
Okie dokie. I believe then, Mr. Larry, we are on this little piece that you put in here about Iowa, unless I have missed something.
No, that's where we are.
Cool. So I got nothing that goes along with this one. So Iowa, first of all, what is an HF?
House file.
Is this related to a House bill or a Senate bill? Is that similar?
It's a House bill that has become law in the state of Iowa that prohibits PFRs. It just was posted today on the listserv. It prevents people that are required to register from for conducting any child care, any babysitting services, you'll find yourself in trouble with the law in Iowa now.
All right. Okay. And like you said, it was just filed today. Why did you bring this up?
Well, I wanted to, I think I've been harping about when these things pass, the governor's going to sign them. I think I harped about a governor just in the last episode about in Maryland, that Governor Hogan would sign the banishment of minors who have been convicted of offenses. You remember that one?
I do.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is the same thing. The governor of Iowa is going to sign this bill. It passed the legislature unanimously, and unanimous in the House, unanimous in the Senate, and it's been signed by the governor. And I just wanted to make the point, when these things are passed unanimously, or near unanimously, with overwhelming bipartisan support, which is what you always yearn for, is bipartisan support. Well, this had plenty of it since it passed unanimously. Right. But this is one of those things where the Democrat Party in Iowa is in a minority. And I put there's a picture there of Iowa General Assembly by party. Yeah, that one, there's 50 senators and there's 32 to 18. The Democrat Party only has 18. Then you look at the House, it's 59 to 41. So it's almost 60-40 in the House. Yep. So now explain to me, if you're in the Democrat Party in Iowa and there's a proposal like this and there's absolutely nothing you can do to stop it, nothing, because you're in such a minority, explain to me why you would oppose something like this, even though you might not believe it's good public policy, because there's nothing you can do about it. And all you do is you look at that up at the top half of there, where there's only 18 members of the Democrat Party. All you do is make those 18 seats vulnerable to the attacks from the right. They'll say, and this person doesn't even deserve to be in the Iowa Senate. They voted pro-sex offender on House Bill 710 last year, or whatever, this is the next election. So this is why people don't expect the minority to save you. When there's something this controversial and there's no political gain in it and only a political loss, whatever the minority party is, I don't care if it's the Republican Party, we can flip this over in the states where the Republicans are irrelevant. California would be an example of that, where the Republicans are totally irrelevant. They have such small numbers. There would be nothing that they would do, nor would there be anything they would try to do, because it would be a wasted effort. There's almost veto override majorities here. Not quite, but almost. but since it was unanimous, you don't need to talk about a veto. But if every single Democrat voted against it, you could almost still pass these with the margins that they have. So there, I just want to do a little civics lesson. You know, folks, politics are the example, or here's an example of, you let it get to the governor signed it. You have to kill this stuff before it makes it to the governor.
And killing it means what? Committees? Is that where you're going?
You either have to make it in the committee where you can live with it, or you have to kill it. And people criticize me for trying to make something where I can live with it, because I'm a sellout at that point. Well, right. if I was going to have a choice between having every PFR in the state of Iowa not allowed to babysit or do any type of child care, or narrowly tailoring something, if I concluded that this was going to pass and there was nothing I could do about it, I would feel better about it if we could narrowly tailor it so that it would only target those where there might be a legitimate concern that they shouldn't be engaging in child care. But see, I would take pies in my face and all sorts of criticism, because I would be a sellout at that point, because I would be negotiating with the system. But which is better, to negotiate and get something that's more narrowly tailored, or have this blanket ban that they have in Iowa now? You tell me.
Hang on, I got a clip for this.
Trying to win the game.
What are you trying to do, Larry?
I'm trying to win the game, and I would consider it a win if I could have narrowly tailored this bill. And when the political realities, you have to deal with political reality. I would have gone to leadership and said, are you people going to pass this? Yes, sir, we're going to have to pass it. Okay, I want to try to narrow it a little bit and bring it within the contours of constitutionality. And I would have enough respect that they would actually listen to me and say, we need to narrow this a little bit. But again, we don't have much of an advocacy in Iowa. And this is what happens with your bipartisanship. You had plenty of it here.
I see. And we have we'll have a link to the show notes of this House file. It's a House File 710, if you want to go find it in the show notes. Anything else here before we go on to the main event?
I think I beat that dead horse. It was a civics lesson all I was trying to do.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
This one is a recent decision from the Supreme Court. Is that where you want to go? Correct?
Let's do it. That way, if we run out of time, we can skip some articles.
Yeah, of course, of course. It's a case of Alaska versus Sean Wright. Larry, I did read all of it. It was pretty short. I can't see what it has to do with PFRs except for that Wright is a PFR, and he took it before the Supreme Court. It's all about habeas corpus. I won't trash that word that bad. It's habeas corpus, which nobody ever wins these days. I don't know anybody that ever files any. And I do see that the Supreme Court reversed a Ninth Circuit decision, which is their favorite thing to do. What is this case about? And here it is for you. 1 minute or less.
Well, I'm not sure I can do it in a minute or less to unpack all these issues.
You're going to have to get on that.
So, hopefully now you see the reason why we have the article from the New Yorker titled The Destruction of Defendants' Rights. Sean Wright was convicted in Alaska back in 2009 of sexual crimes, and he completed his Alaska sentence, and then he decided to move to Tennessee. And he chose, after arriving in Tennessee, to ignore his registration obligation. And guess what? He found himself being prosecuted by the feds. I just mentioned that. If you've traveled in interstate commerce, the feds convicted him, or he pled, of failure to comply with his registration obligation. And he received a sentence of time served plus 5 years of supervised release. I'm just guessing that he found supervised release to be somewhat of a bummer, and he decided to try to undo his Alaska conviction utilizing a petition for a writ of habeas corpus as the vehicle. He reasoned that if his Alaska conviction could be undone in a habeas proceeding, his federal conviction for failing to register would be voided because the predicate conviction would no longer exist, which would mean he would have no registration obligation. So that's what this case is about.
All right. So I see where you're heading. You're itching to explain the limitations of a federal habeas, particularly in view of the restrictions imposed by the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, commonly referred to as AEDPA. Is that how it would be pronounced? AEDPA?
That's fine.
I've heard you pontificate about the harm done by it's AEDPA, anti-terrorism. You have the acronym there wrong. And now you have this article from the New Yorker published in 2015.
Well, I did suggest the article, so the audience will actually see that it's not just me saying this, that AEDPA is bad. So I'd like to just read one of the quotes from the article. This law gutted the federal writ of habeas corpus, which a federal court can use to order release of someone wrongfully imprisoned. It is often called the Great Writ because of its extraordinary power to protect the liberty of individuals. In the 1960s, the Supreme Court expanded the law of habeas corpus as a protection against unfair treatment of defendants at every stage of criminal process, from arrest, interrogation, through trial and sentencing, especially in cases of death sentences. This expansion was controversial, and under Chief Justice William Rehnquist, by the way, appointed by President Reagan, the court later restricted the availability of the writ. But the protection that the writ gave, even when it was limited, was indispensable. a dramatically high percentage of individual sentenced to death had their sentences reversed owing to errors by trial courts. That is a quote from the article. I encourage everyone to read that, the entire article.
But this is from the Ninth Circuit, and I'm guessing you have a point that you would like to make about the Ninth Circuit's view on AEDPA before we get into the actual case at hand.
Yes, I do. You've heard me mention Judge Stephen Reinhardt, who's now deceased, and he served on the Ninth Circuit for many years, and he wrote the following, and I'm going to quote again from this article. While AEDPA was misconceived at its inception, the deeply conservative Supreme Court has repeatedly interpreted in the most inflexible, unyielding manner possible, so that constitutional rulings by state courts are nearly unreviewable by the federal judiciary. The appeals courts, including the Ninth Circuit, dutifully follow existing Supreme Court law. The Supreme Court often, this is just Judge Reinhardt, the Supreme Court often reverses us, not for failing to apply the law it has previously enunciated, but by creating new, previously undeclared, and extreme rules that serve to limit the ability of federal courts to enforce the rights embodied in the Constitution. End of quote by Judge Reinhardt. This
what
was
should
passed.
Have Wright done instead of filing the habeas?
Yeah, this. By the way, this was passed in 1996 in the glory days of Newt Gingrich and the conservatives that had control of Congress, and this is a lingering effect. And we're also going to talk about the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which was also passed in the glory days of the 1990s. But what should he have filed instead of the habeas corpus?
Well,
first he should have registered in Tennessee. Folks, if you have a registration obligation and you cross state lines, you must present yourself to the new state. They may tell you that their registration obligations are not as extensive, and it could be that they will tell you that you don't have an obligation, but you must present yourself for registration and let them decide what to do with you. If you do not present yourself, the loop is left open in the state that you moved from. They will notify the feds. The feds have virtually unlimited resources. They will track you down, and they will prosecute you federally. But second, he should not have used Section 2254, which is for those who are in state custody. He is clearly not in state custody per AEDPA. He had exhausted his Alaska sentence in its entirety, and he's in federal custody. Now he's serving a supervised release, which under the expanded definition of custody, that does count as custody, but there's a separate section, 2255, that he should have used because he's not in state custody.
All right, so you're saying he should now file a new petition using 2255. That's what you just said.
Well, I said that that's what the Supreme Court said. If he does it, that's not going to do any good either. But it is...
Thank you for setting me up for failure.
Well, I'm just telling you, the Supreme Court said that if he has a vehicle to ride, it would be 2255 because he's not in. That's for those who are in federal custody. And if he uses 2255, even though they suggested that's the proper vehicle, that won't work either because the scope of that inquiry will be limited to the validity of the federal provision that he's convicted under, which is traveling in interstate commerce. And what is going to happen then, the federal judge, when looking at 2255, they're going to say, you are a person, are you not? Yes. You did travel across from state A to state B, did you not?
Yes.
And then he's going to say, well, the law says that you were required to register and you didn't. So why are we here? So that's not going to do any good either.
And what was that? So what did he do?
Well, I don't know what he really can do, but remember, he pled guilty to one count of failure to register under 18 United States Code 2250A. And since there's no federal registry, Wright only was convicted because he traveled in interstate commerce and he failed to comply with Tennessee's registration requirements. And I do have to say that this does seem like a light sentence because he was sentenced to time served, and they're not clear on how much time he had served, but normally you get several years in the federal system. So he got time served and he got 5 years of supervised release. So and federal prosecutions generally move fairly rapidly. So I'm not convinced he had a whole lot of time. in when he got this relatively modest sentence. But as far as I'm concerned, he's not got a lot of options except for maybe going into state court again in Alaska and trying to challenge some constitutional aspect of his conviction. But he's not going to get there in federal court.
When you talk about vehicles, can we circle back to that? We talked about this almost like from the nexus of our relationship of using the proper vehicle. A writ of mandamus was a vehicle, a type of vehicle. What do you mean by this term vehicle?
Well, when you file seeking relief, the petition that you file has to be, the scope of it has to be broad enough to allow you to seek the type of relief that you are asking. If you file a petition for restitution in a landlord-tenant dispute, if you file a petition for a writ of restitution, that's the proper vehicle. If you don't file a petition for writ of restitution, if you just file a civil lawsuit saying that you want damages from the person, the court isn't allowed to give you the writ of restitution, which is the order directing the law enforcement to go out and dispossess you. So you would not, the scope of their relief would not be available. When you're filing when you're filing a petition for habeas corpus after the 1996 amendments, the AEDPA puts severe restrictions on what type of relief can be granted, what claims are cognizable, and what the standards are. And you have extreme time limits, and you have deference to the state courts unless it's clearly contrary to U.S. Supreme Court precedent. And you have, all claims are not cognizable. Like, for example, he wasn't in custody. So he lost out simply because he was not in custody as required by the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. He was not in state custody. So you cannot file a petition seeking relief from a state court conviction when you're not in custody, in some form of at least expanded custody. And so therefore he was not riding the correct vehicle. The correct vehicle for him to possibly seek relief is the section that permits a person in federal custody. But that's not going to go anywhere either, because the scope of the examination is going to be so limited to whether or not he was properly convicted of the federal offense. They're not going to get into the Alaska conviction. I would be very surprised. So he's going to end up with no relief when he files the right petition. But I know I'm not supposed to say that either.
We need to take a tiny little detour. There's a conversation in chat going on about using the car analogy for registration stuff, and it certainly ties into this case from the Supreme Court that we're talking about. But a car is a thing that you register. We are people that are registering, and last time I checked, we're not cars. You're not a car, are you, Larry? But there's a distinction there, isn't there? We're not registering people.
There's a distinction in terms of what we're registering, but that's only the distinction is minor. The fact is, it's still a civil regulatory scheme. And the state that you're going to move into, whether you're moving the car or your person, you will comply with the regulations, the regulatory scheme as it exists in that state. You don't get to bring the regulatory scheme from the state that you came from with you and impose that on the receiving state that's receiving you now. And it's not the receiving formally as interstate compact, so that's really not a good term. But you don't get to change the rules of that state. If you don't like the rules, simply don't go there.
Yeah, but the point that I wanted to get is it's a sexual offense registry. It's not a sex offender registry. It's a sexual offense registry. We're registering the offenses in these states. I realize
Really?
There's a person attached to it. Isn't that haven't we talked about that recently?
Well, now that is, there's an organization that's trying to change that to be less offensive to say the sexual offense registry. But try going and registering the offenses and see what they say.
I understand that, but I thought that the point I was trying to get across is that we're registering the offenses and not the people. I realize that there's a person associated with the registration of the offense, but the former is the offense and then the person is attached to it. It's kind of like registering the car and you have a VIN number. I don't know if that's a right analogy.
Well, I don't quite follow you, because they're registering you.
Okay.
They're not registering the offense. They're registering you. It's your DNA.
All right, well,
they
never
take
mind.
It's your fingerprints they take. it's your everything that they take. Your photograph.
Then I'm mixing up that I get, like you just said, there was somebody that's trying to change it to be a sexual offense registry, and that's not what it is currently. I got gotcha.
Well, Well, I get the reason for it, because you have offended. It assumes that you're still offending if you say the sexual offender registry. And,
sure.
And that's in the past. Hopefully that's in the past.
The individual is also being very Debbie Downer, as the term that he used for that we're not going to have any progress. And Brenda and I are trying to give him some level of optimism that things are moving. Maybe it's two steps forward, one step backwards. And you certainly have successes in your state. Not always, but mostly.
Somewhat, yes.
And people around, the people that do fight, I couldn't remember the attorney's name in Colorado. I cannot. Colleen Kelly? It just came to me. Is that an attorney who won the case? Who's the one that won that case for like the four people?
That wasn't Colleen. But her name's escaping me also.
Okay. There is another attorney over there. That is doing work and could certainly use support and help however those things go about. I suppose, is there anything else you wanted to cover on this case before we move out of that section?
No, we can go to the Prison Litigation Reform Act.
Prison Litigation Reform Act. I don't know which one that is. Oh, okay. I see it.
From the appeal. Yeah, and this is too long. It's too long for us to get into great detail about it. But what I want to make a point that this happened in the same time frame as the restriction on habeas corpus. These were bad laws. And if you read the article from the appeal, they go into great detail telling you how difficult it is to win a lawsuit against prisons. We claim that we want to see prison conditions improve, that we want to see reforms in prison conditions. If you truly do mean that, then you will work to try to repeal the Prison Litigation Reform Act, because it's very difficult now. The volume of cases has plummeted since 1996, and the successful cases has even plummeted beyond that. And prison conditions, I think most would say, have not gotten better since 1996. So if you truly do want reform, this is bad public policy that was put through in the 90s that needs to be revisited, just like the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which no one could vote against. Very few did vote against it, because how could you oppose? This was driven by the bombing in Oklahoma City by McVeigh. Okay. And, mm-hmm. and they didn't have a death penalty. And it bothered them to no end that they didn't have a death penalty, an effective death penalty at the federal level. And then it was hijacked during the process to include the restriction on habeas corpus, because the judges were saying they were being inundated with all these state claims. And the conservatives said that we have perpetual litigation, and our state courts are not being respected for the hard work that they do. So that provision was added into it. And those were all bad laws, and we need to work on changing those laws.
And the article that we're talking about came from the AP, Second Chance Alabama Approves Expungement Bill, but it's only for low-level crimes to have their records wiped clean. Just want to make sure people knew what we were talking about and where we were going with that.
We're just now moving to Alabama. We were talking about the Prison Litigation Reform Act previously, but now we're moving to the Alabama Expungement Bill.
Well, then I was talking about the wrong one. All right, well, then let's talk about the AP Bill, Second Chance Alabama Approves Expungement Bill. Tell us, this is about Alabama moving low-level crime that apply and have their records wiped clean, and Governor Kay Ivey has signed it. Why'd you bring this one up?
It's positive news, and we have so little of it that I thought it would be worthwhile. It's certainly a very narrow, but it's a step, and it's a positive step. Unfortunately, guess what? If you read the first paragraph, no, it's the third paragraph down, you see that Alabama decided to exclude PFRs. Violent crimes, sex offenses, and major traffic convictions will not be eligible for expungement. So,
Of course.
Yeah. So, but I would encourage people in Alabama, the names are here of the drivers behind this bill. Senator Linda Coleman from Madison and Representative Chris England from Tuscaloosa. Those are key drivers of this bill. Have conversations with them. and find out if they feel like that they can come back and expand it upon it. It said the bill passed the Senate without a dissenting vote. The House of Representatives approved the measure on a 57-38 vote. So it was not nearly strong in the House. And I didn't dig into who the 37 were that opposed it. But don't let this be the end of it. This is the first step.
Right. And then we will move over to an article from Mississippi. It says Mississippi prisons end a contract with controversial food provider from CBS News. A company accused of serving rotten and spoiled meals to inmates in Mississippi is no longer providing food in the state's correctional facilities. Larry, this is an amazing victory that people aren't going to be eating rotten food. That's amazing.
So when the state began a new three-year deal with a company, Merchants Food Service, on March 1st to provide meals to 15 prisons. But I can't believe from the description of this, this was pretty bad stuff that they were serving. But remember,
we talked about stuff like this more than a single or double time, that this is just, this has got to be probably the second or third largest resource consumer for a prison budget is food. And any place that they could scrounge a couple bucks away, boy, so we'll keep the food. Maybe we'll keep the cooler a little bit warmer so we can save some money on the electricity bill.
So, well, Mississippi certainly has had its share of notoriety for bad prison conditions and violence. And I think the governor blamed it on cell phones. Remember, we talked about that a year ago or so about, he said that the problem was cell phones. You remember that?
Yes. Parchman. Yep.
Yeah. So, again, folks, this reflects back really to us, the people, we the people. If you made it clear to the people you elect to represent you in Jackson that you wanted your inmates treated humanely, that you wanted them to have good food, and you wanted them to have rehabilitation services, if you made that clear, that's the way it would be. But you do just the opposite. When you look in the mirror each morning, remember it's you that says that you don't care what they have to suffer, that they should have thought about that when they did their crime, that I'm out here working, paying taxes, killing myself, and these people in prison are living better than I do. They have three hots and a cot. They have free health care. Remember, these politicians that are representing you are reflecting you.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. We could do better if we wanted to, but we have decided that we don't. It's a really terrible thing to say.
Try running for, I think I said last episode, try running for state office on a platform that you want to make prisons better, and tell me how that goes for you.
All right, and then from the Detroit Free Press, the Supreme Court is wrong. Even children who kill don't deserve life without parole. These sentences ignore brain research and are tainted by racial bias. Until last week's opinion, the court was headed towards closing the door on them. Geez, Larry, why did you put this in here?
Well, I think it's a good thing to follow up on last week's episode, because I reminded folks that the Supreme Court had strayed from previous precedent and said that this conservative court, 6-3, with all the conservatives being in lockstep, said that previously, the court had it wrong when they said juvenile life without parole was unconstitutional without an incorrigibility finding. Well, this is an opinion of the Detroit newspaper, Free Press, that says that the Supreme Court should legislate from the bench. I'm not expressing an opinion, folks. I'm just asking you, do you want the Supreme Court to come in and save you from this, or do you want the state of Mississippi, I believe it was. I think it was Mississippi, because they were overturning the precedent that had been previous from Alabama. Do you want the Supreme Court to come save you from yourself, or do you want to do the right thing and change the law so that people in Mississippi, juveniles, will not be subject to life sentences without parole? Whose responsibility is it? I'm posing the question. I am not expressing a view at this point.
Yeah. Should they email crackpot at Registry Matters, or how? may I take a stab?
Sure.
we would want them to be handled as close to the people as we want to, unless we deem it to be so repugnant that we want it to be that way for the entire country. And that's where either federal legislation or something like this gets stepped into with the Supreme Court. But we would want as many laws to be handled as local as possible, because that would be the governor and your city council, whatever your state type, your local representatives. Those were the ones that know the local issues and know the community and the attitudes of the peoples.
Well, now let's just reflect on some of the Scalia clips. Does something simply because it's repugnant magically become unconstitutional?
Clearly not.
Okay, well, repugnant, then it's not the proper standard if you are following the Scalia model. He says,
I know,
that the people certainly are not required to impose the death penalty, not the death penalty, life without parole. And he said the same thing about the death penalty. They're not required to impose the death penalty. They're choosing to impose the death penalty. He says that there was nothing in the framers' mind about having a prohibition about the death penalty, against using the death penalty. Same thing about this. Nobody in the constitutional making process ever thought about putting limitations on what type of sentences could be handed down by the people, the people's representatives. So do you want to invent this in the Constitution and have the court decide what the proper punishment levels can be? Or do you want your elected officials? Which is it? And like I say, I'm posing the question. Larry said this, because I'm only asking. I'm trying to promote intellectual honesty, because it seems like we like the court to step in and do things we agree with.
Right. And when
we can't win it through the legislative process, then we want judicial intervention.
Right.
And then we get mad about judicial intervention if they intervene in a way inconsistent with our beliefs. So which is it, folks? Do you want the courts to save you, or do you want to save yourselves?
That we need them to be super legislators when we need them to be super legislators. Otherwise, stand back.
I see.
All right, one last article, and we are out of here. This is Westmoreland County Prison to pay inmates at prison to get coronavirus vaccine. Oh, sweet. They're going to get some kind of little bonus, like 25 cents or something. They're going to get $25 in commissary credit if they receive the vaccine. That's amazing.
It is. And I'm not sure where that county is, but being that you know the state inside out, what's the county seat of Westmoreland?
Westmoreland County? Hang on. Westmoreland County, PA. I'm using Google as we speak to find out where it is. Someone in chat, if you know, really quick, tell me where it is. Oh, God. Google, be faster, please. It is just east of Pittsburgh, it looks like.
So, well, I put it in there simply because I think it's novel. I think it's creative. And I like it. You would have to think that since there's hesitancy on the street, people, including me, I've had some hesitancy since my brother had the reactions he did to the Moderna shots. I've had some hesitancy. And this modest amount of money, if it overcomes hesitancy and makes the facility safer for the inmates as well as the staff, I think it's very creative. $25 isn't a whole lot of money. And if you can push someone in the right direction by that, isn't that a great thing?
Sure, $25 is not a lot of commissary money, because I bet you soups are like 75 cents by now. But I would do it in a heartbeat. I got my second shot a couple days ago. I am pleased.
So I would bet a lot of inmates that are on the fence would go in favor of the $25. And then we achieve the herd immunity, at least within the institution. You know, so I think it's a great idea. And you folks that are listening to us and reading our transcripts on Westmoreland County, tell us what $25 will do for you.
I imagine we can get pretty much anybody, because the way JPay is, as far as whatever the organizations are, Securus, that is running commissary for everybody, it's got to be 75 cents a soup. It doesn't go that far, but it's not zero either. So I would do it. I would do it.
So
Larry, we have finished up with everything.
Yeah, we got some acknowledgments, though.
Oh, we do. We had two subscribers actually directly to the transcript service, and the first one was Sean, different Sean than what we covered earlier, and he sent in a letter, and it said we'll get to that letter in a future episode. And then also Douglas said, I want to thank you people for sending me a transcript from Registry Matters 171. And everyone in chat, you have to take a quick shot because we said you people again.
So, all righty. Well, see, our transcript, we're going to grow this transcript distribution. It's going to soon surpass every prison publication.
That would be, oh man, we could be bigger than Prison Policy, Prison Legal News. That would be fun.
I believe it's going to happen within 3 years.
That's a pretty lofty expectation there. But I'm up for the challenge. With that, we will shut it down, Larry, and I think everyone can go find all of the pertinent information over at registrymatters.co. You can find links to everything if you want to sign up on Patreon. That's patreon.com/registrymatters. And if there's nothing else, Larry, I will bid you a happy, wonderful good night and the rest of your weekend, and I will talk to you soon.
Thanks, and I appreciate being here again.
Take care, buddy.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.